I want to tell you my secret now. I see dead people.
Silent Green is evil!
Need my sister and my daughter!
Rosebud.
What's in the box?
Hello, and thank you for joining us for this spoiler special for John Wick, Chapter 3, Parabellum. I am Sam Adams, Senior Editor at Slate, and joining me are Forrest Wickman, Slate's Culture Editor.
Hey, Sam.
And Matthew Dessem, who is the Nights and Weekends Editor of Browbeat.
Hello.
Welcome, Team Culture. So we are going to talk about John Wick 3 today. Normally, this is the part of the podcast where I summarize the plot of the movie. In this case, that is... people are trying to kill John Wick, and he kills them. One of the features of these movies, which has become increasingly apparent as we get, you know, further into the series and people get more the hang of it, is they are just kind of machines to string together a bunch of generally pretty amazing action sequences. And that is very much true in this case. This movie starts, I think, 6 minutes after the end of the last one, something that is essentially continuous. John Wick was given an hour after killing someone on the grounds of the hotel, the Continental, which is sort of like a neutral zone for this international coven of assassins. He's broken the cardinal rule of this place. He is given 1 hour to get clear before he is excommunicado, and basically every assassin in the world will be after him. And so we start off with the clock ticking at about 56 minutes and him running away from it. Before we get into spoiling what plot there is in this movie, Forrest and Matt, what's your position on the John Wick series thus far going into part three?
Yeah, I reviewed the first one for Slate and really loved it. And it kind of came out of nowhere, and people were kind of shocked at how smart and funny this new Keanu Reeves movie was. I mean, Keanu had been coming off a sort of low point in his career, I guess. And then I've generally really loved these movies ever since, while also feeling slightly queasy about them. I mean, they're extremely violent, and I have a sort of limited stomach for that. And they're also like extremely fetishizing of violence and specifically of guns. But they're also very funny and I think work best for me as a comedy. And this was maybe my favorite one. I'm not sure where you would rank them, Dessem. I believe you reviewed the second John Wick for Slate.
Yeah, I loved the first one too for the same reasons you're talking about. The second one I found like I liked it, and there are some very like smart and well-executed things in it. But I just found it, the violence got a little tedious in that one. This one I loved. I thought was great. I mean, as you say, I have some qualms too about the guns and it and so on. But I thought it played more as like a slapstick kind of thing this time around. And I liked it a lot.
Yeah, and an important thing to say, to point out for listeners who may be coming into the series with part three. And I should say, although on the one hand, it has this fairly sort of complicated and ornate mythology,
right,
very little of that is necessary to understanding what's going on with the plot. So you can really feel free to jump in at any point. This is not something where you really need to have seen John Wick's 1 and 2 to get what's going on in this one, which again is he's trying to kill people. They're trying to kill him.
And I would even add that like if you've seen the previous two movies, I mean, maybe I just don't remember them that well, but like all of the mythology of these various tokens and stuff, a lot of it feels like they're kind of making it up as they go. Like, in other words, even if you've seen the previous two movies, I'm not sure exactly how much sense it makes.
Right. I mean, I think the only important thing to know about the series is, you know, as you mentioned, Forrest, Keanu kind of hadn't really done a major movie really since the end of the Matrix sequels in 2003. And this series came out of the co-director of the first movie and the director of the second two is Chad Stahelski, who was a stunt coordinator. And before that, a stunt performer who was Keanu's stunt double on the Matrix trilogy. And you know, he moved into directing with this franchise. And he's someone who, I mean, I think among other things, really appreciates Keanu Reeves' strengths primarily as a physical actor. I mean, there's very little dialogue in these movies and really very little need for it. That is sort of the beauty of them. And I think that has to do very much with their attitude towards violence in this one. There's a subplot in this one, which perhaps we'll get to later, but that involves Angelica Houston as this sort of gang leader slash, you know, ballet impresario. And they really do, I mean, they do approach, you know, violence very much as dance, as this kind of thing in you know, physical movement. It reminds me of the sort of famous Jean-Luc Godard quote about how someone said, you know, that in one of his movies there was a lot of blood, and he said, "That's not blood, that's red." So I think you have to kind of approach these movies in that spirit. It was interesting for me seeing this movie with, it was a preview screening, but there was an audience for it. And we get to kind of the first of the movie's major kills, which we'll talk about in just a sec. The audience was giving me this kind of like, yeah, reaction. And I was, and that actually struck me as weird because I was, as you said, Ford, I was laughing at it because it's just, I mean, it is very self-consciously silly and ridiculous. And I think that's, I heard from somebody who like sat, you know, a couple rows behind Keanu Reeves at the premiere of this movie, and he was laughing too. And I really think that's maybe sort of dodging a moral bullet by not taking the killing seriously. But I think that, you know, appreciating this as kind of a sort of very bloody, deadly slapstick comedy is kind of the way to go.
Yeah. And I mean, that's, I think, the other level on which in these movies, Keanu Reeves is really good. I mean, in addition to being an actor who is quite, at this point, quite skilled as like a martial artist and a wielder of guns, lots of guns, as he says again in this movie, he really works in these movies because he, I mean, I'm not sure Keanu Reeves is capable of doing that much more than kind of deadpanning everything. But what he does in this movie, which is just being very laconic and growling and only speaking like four words at a time, really works for deadpanning everything. You know, Matt, the one thing we have talked about with this movie and these movies in general is their like apparent relation to the films of Buster Keaton, which I think really works. I mean, you know, Buster Keaton was a sort of stuntman and director in one who just remains stone-faced through everything. And, like, that's one thing Keanu Reeves does really well in these movies is just remain stone-faced while everything that happens around him is utterly ridiculous. And I think that works, like, fantastically.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I would say the other thing about the violence that makes it a little easier is that it's not, the world of the film is so ridiculous that it doesn't you don't feel like, oh wow, that would really be a mess on the streets of New York City if somebody did this. You think like this weird neon nightmare land is having a bad night, you know, like everything is so over the top that it doesn't make me squeamish the same way. But I, what you're saying about Keaton, I agree totally. Like this movie could not be more designed around just, you know, stunts and action sequences and the same kind of stuff that he did there, which I also think makes the violence a little easier because it's just so spectacular.
Right. Yeah. To the extent there's any plot, it's just like, what are the ways in which John Wick will kill all the guys? And I feel like that's how we should go through this movie, is just go through the various ways in which John Wick kills people in John Wick :Chapter 3.
Okay, so when John Wick leaves the Continental, the clock is ticking. He has 1 hour to get to a sort of minimum safe distance before every assassin in New York gets the message on their little sort of antiquated flip phones. And naturally, his first stop is the New York Public Library.
Yeah, I loved how he immediately, like, the first laugh for me was just John Wick. First of all, he walks down the street with his dog, and he's, like, the only New Yorker who doesn't need a leash for his dog, even in Times Square. And then he just, like, jumps immediately into a cab with his wet dog, and, like, the cabbie doesn't say anything about it, about this wet pit bull. And then heads to the New York Public Library, where we finally get to this first big action sequence, which maybe you should describe, Desim.
Yeah, so he goes to the New York Public Library. He requests a very specific book that doesn't actually exist, but goes and gets it, and he's hidden in it. It's a bunch of tokens that are apparently very valuable. And was there even a gun in there? I think it was just valuables, right?
I believe it's some of these sort of gold coins, and there's a rosary, which is going to sort of factor into the plot later. Yeah.
So it's just stuff he needs to disappear. But then, as often happens in these movies, a gigantic man appears and tries to kill John Wick, which doesn't go very well for him.
A gigantic man who I didn't realize until I read this on the internet later is an NBA player. Did you know this, guys?
I might have. Or, I mean, he's certainly very tall. And the book that, and is he Russian or
his? So he's a Serbian NBA player. He's 7'3". So he's in fact the tallest player in the NBA. His name is Boban Marjanovic. And yeah, I mean, basically he comes off as sort of a like Jaws type figure where he doesn't really say anything. He just shows up and is twice as tall as our hero.
Yeah, and there has been a sort of theme, or that feels like a strong word, but it's some sort of a little skittering idea running through all these movies. Going back to the first one, kind of linking Keanu Reeves' character to the kind of Russian boogeyman, or the Baba Yaga, as they translate it. And so the book that he's requesting, that he's hidden the stuff in the library, is this ancient book of Russian folktales. And then he is attacked by this Eastern European assassin as well. And John Wick being John Wick, he has no weapons, but a large book of Russian folktales is all he needs to kill somebody.
We should describe this precise mechanics of what he does, which is, first of all, he holds the book up in front of the giant's face, punches the book into the giant's face repeatedly. Then he puts it in his mouth and punches the book so it goes into the giant's teeth and breaks his teeth.
Yeah, it's like curb stomping him, but with a book of fairy tales.
That's the final thing that he does, which is he like goes over to the reading table, sets the book down on the reading table, somehow manages to position the giant over the binding of the book, and then like hits the giant's head down so his neck breaks over the book. And yeah, I think my theater was in a combination of riotous laughter and people doing, you know, kind of loud oh shits.
And it's funny, I mean, I don't think this is sort of a deliberate like piss take on the scene in the Jason Bourne movies where he like attacks a guy with a rolled up magazine, but I mean, I could not sort of help but think of that. I mean, so it's, you know, it is the sort of, he is a killing machine, anything that's handy can be used as a weapon in this, but it's just, you know, takes it to this like incredible extreme here. And this is, I mean, you know, the rest of the movie, the things that tend to be handy are much more conventional killing machines. The next fight that he has after this is in the kind of display aisle of a knife shop.
Yeah, what was that thing? I mean, he goes into this warehouse that's like, it's basically every smashable thing that you would want in an action movie, plus like every possible weapon. So it's like a bunch of chandeliers. It's a bunch of mirrors. There's like a hall of knives. There's like a room full of antique guns.
It's your standard antique glassware and like stabbing weapon warehouse.
I love that though. Like, I love that its vision, these movies, their vision of the city is like every business that you're not quite sure what they do. If you go back far enough, there's this lavishly decorated arms dealing, you know, warehouse or whatever. Like, the difference between the fronts of all of the businesses in this and the interiors are amazing.
I think one of my favorite things about this too is it has this very just kind of baked in concept of New York as a city that has, you know, this sort of is typical of New York as a city that's like seen it all. But I mean, in that scene you described for us where he gets into the cab and then there's like a lot of traffic and he just leaves his dog with the cab, and says, okay, take him to the Continental. And the cabbie goes, you know, yes, sir, Mr. Wick. And it's like the cabbie knew who he was all along. And one of the things that runs through this movie is that John Wick, who was kind of a feared figure in the first movie, is now kind of a celebrity. And he's sort of the famous person that like everybody wants to like get in a fist fight with Mike Tyson or something. Like, everybody wants to kill John Wick because he's like, they're like, oh, I'm such a big fan. Now I have to kill you. But there's also a fight scene later where he like stabs two people to death on a walkway in Grand Central and they just drop to the floor in the middle of like rush hour or commuting traffic. And the people around them do not flinch or budge or acknowledge it at all.
Yeah, it's sort of like a reprisal of there's a sequence in the second one where they're walking through, I'm blanking on the name of it, but the sort of new train station in South Manhattan, and Keanu and John Wick and a hitman played by Common are like shooting each other. They are using silencers, but they're like having an entire shootout in the middle of this extremely large crowd of people, and the New Yorkers just like don't.
Right, and it's not even, in this movie, it's not even like played for a joke. It just happens and it moves on. It's just kind of taken as read that like New Yorkers don't give a shit.
Yeah, it's part of the like straight-facedness of these movies that I really like.
Maybe they finally did the math on how many people the Continental and its associated businesses would have to be employing and realized everyone in New York was aware of what was happening.
Yes, they are a major employer in the tri-state area. Yeah, so they wield quite a lot of influence. So knife fight now. What do we think of the knife fight?
I loved it. The thing where he threw the knives at the guy, and I guess there's like a knife holder, right? A novelty knife holder that's like a little figure that you stick all the knives in. Do you guys know this thing?
Sort of.
There's a guy with like six knives sticking out of his chest through most of this fight, and it's the same sort of thing. It's like one knife in a chest is really sad and frightening, but like six, well, the guy looks like a pincushion. It's kind of funny. I mean, I thought they did a good job of making incredibly horrible violence, sort of timed right and slapsticky.
Yeah, and it's not, you know, sanitized exactly. It's, like, quite bloody. And there is, you know, one of the few, like, kind of genuinely gruesome scenes in this movie is at the end of this fight where he, like, actually, you know, sticks a knife, like, up to the edge of somebody's eye and, like, shoves it into his skull. You know, like, that's actually, you know, the violence is kind of rarely, it's often kind of, like, gross, but not often disturbing. That was the one where you're like, ooh, like, that's.
Yeah, and that was also very just effectively shot in a way that I was left trying to puzzle out exactly how they do it. So, like, another thing that these movies do really well is incorporate, you know, CGI blood and gore very seamlessly into these action scenes so that you can have all these long takes and you, like, kind of don't know what's a squib and what's CGI. And that sequence, presumably, they had, you know, like, maybe they made a fake head of that guy in classic. I don't know. I couldn't quite tell how they did it. And that I think is just representative of the quality of effects in these movies generally.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, these movies have one of the things that kind of they made their reputation on is, again, they're kind of, you know, come out of, they're made sort of by stuntmen. A lot of the performers are, you know, stuntmen. Or actual martial artists, or, you know, people who kind of float between the two. So they are shot in a lot of these very long, apparently unbroken takes, although you never know with, you know, technology now how much of that is actually legit. And obviously there's a lot of erased, you know, safety apparatus that's taken out of the frame. But, you know, the blood splatter, I think, is sort of traditionally in most movies now, almost all of that is CG just because it's like makes a mess and that the squibs never go off quite right. And that, I think, is like fairly cheap to add to, you know, a frame. So I think all of that is, and maybe even the muzzle flashes and stuff like that are added in later.
But what about the horses, Sam? We have to get, I'm just eager to get past the knife fight so we can get to my favorite way that John Wick killed a bad guy in this movie, which is right across from the Chandeliers Knives and Antique Guns store. There is a horse stable, apparently.
I mean, of course, yeah, you know, as one
sort
finds.
Of set that up with those Central Park things coming out of there, right? There must be a horse stable somewhere in Manhattan because you've got horses.
Yeah. That's true. That's true. Anyway, he has a fight with these guys in the horse stable, and his way of killing one guy is that he hits the horse so that the horse kicks back into this guy's head, which he then repeats like at least one, maybe two more times, which there's just a quality of these movies where it feels like a bunch of people just sat around thinking, like, how can John Wick kill people in this movie? And they, like, throw out ideas. And then they're just like, yes, that's in the movie.
I mean, that's true of a lot of, you know, a lot of kind of modern action filmmaking. When we, you know, talked about the Mission Impossible movies before, we talked about how those are, you know, literally built. And really, since even the second one, I think, that John Woo directed, they're built up from set pieces. And then the plot is engineered to fit between them. John Wick makes very little effort to pretend that it is anything other than that. And that is, you know, it may be to your taste or not. You may prefer to, you know, have a little sort of dressed up a little bit more and pretend there is more of a plot. But this is very, like, you know, it does not take long to get to the fireworks factory here. Yeah. You were just kind of moving from one section of the fireworks factory to another section of the fireworks factory for two.
Yeah, I think it's been two movies since they haven't been, like, right in the middle of the fireworks factory for every scene.
So there's the horse fight. And it's actually, I think it is even harder than in the Mission Impossible movies to kind of keep track of when does the motorcycle chase come in? Is that after that?
I mean,
or
it's
that
right
later?
After that, I think, like, because John Wick then gets on one of the horses and just, like, rides away and they chase after him on motorcycles.
Yes.
And that must be how he gets to Angelica Houston. But yeah, I don't know if you guys have anything to say about the horse versus motorcycle fight, which is pretty spectacular. And is, like, largely in, you know, long take or what appears to be an uninterrupted sequence.
Yeah, and that's a lot. I mean, the motorcycle stuff, I mean, must be, that has to be CG somehow because it's just, like, way too deep. But he is literally kind of, you know, he ends up on a bridge and it's kind of has got, like, you know, people on motorcycles pursuing on either side and ends up somehow, like, jamming something into the wheels of one and basically, like, kind of knocks over one motorcycle with another motorcycle. He's, you know, sort of, like, actually using, like, motorcycles as weapons, which is really, I mean, spectacular and seems, if they had done it for real, extraordinarily dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, however they did it, it was, like, very effective, where, like, the magic trick, I couldn't quite figure out how the magic trick worked in a way that was enjoyable.
Right. I mean, which is another, you know, enjoyable thing, you know, fun thing about kind of stunt work as well. There's just kind of, oh, wow, the people are like really doing this for real. And they're really, you know, throwing those kicks and those punches and, you know, did those dives and those flips and whatever. And then there's the kind of like, how did they, you know, hide that trick or whatever. And I think you really, you know, you get the sense of someone who has spent an entire career and probably, you know, several somebody spent an entire career just kind of coming up with ideas that maybe, you know, didn't quite work in some movie or another because like it wasn't right for the character. We can't, you know, we need to see the actor's face and so we can't stage this. And it's just like, what if we put them all in a movie and there was nothing to stop us from using them because nothing actually needs to make sense.
Yeah, it's sort of an amazing, amazingly boiled down concept there where it really is it's simple enough that they just can go with like, well, this time let's do samurai swords on motorcycles. Let's see what that, yeah. Let's play out every permutation we can get with those props or whatever.
All right. So the three things that John finds in that book of fairy tales at the beginning are these gold coins, which are just the currency of the kind of assassin underworld. And then there is a rosary, which takes him to Angelica Houston. And then, which we'll talk about right after this, there's a little kind of sort of like a almost like a makeup compact thing, which has a little flippy kind of compartments on either side that you use. You put your blood in to kind of seal a contract between assassins and pay a debt. And that will take him to the next step in his journey. But first, he goes to visit Angelica Houston, who is the
proprietor of the Tarkovsky Theater.
Yes. Yes, of course, because, I mean, who doesn't think of Tarkovsky when watching these movies?
Right. So there's a way in which these movies, like, I can't tell. So they're definitely very postmodern and self-conscious and, like, almost a spoof in a way that really works. But then they occasionally gesture towards a sort of higher brow, more, like, existential brand of postmodernism. And I like the Tarkovsky thing. I could not make, like, these movies could not be less like a Tarkovsky movie as far as I can tell.
No, I mean, there's probably like more cuts in like 1 5-minute sequence of this movie than like an right. entire, you know, Tarkovsky, like 3-hour Tarkovsky movies. So it may just be like, hey, we like Tarkovsky movies, or they just think, sure. Probably they just think it's funny.
I guess they also were just sitting there like, oh, we need an Eastern European name. Oh, yeah, the Tarkovsky guy.
Yes. So anyway, so he meets Angelica Houston, who is the head of this kind of, you know, Russian gangster kick called the Roma Ruska. And I think at this point out, we find out that John Wick is actually Roma himself, unless it's just a nickname for him. But she calls him something like Georgiani Jovanich or something like that. We've had some arguments about.
I had it down as John Donny Jonovich, which just seems like the name that you make up on the spot if you want to turn John Wick into a Russian name.
Right.
John Donny Jonovich.
Yes. I mean, I think, you know, not to rationalize our collective sloppy note taking, but I think that is how important it is to the plot. Basically, yeah. She kind of says it once and then keeps calling him Giordani or Giandani or whatever it is. But yeah, so he has this ticket, which is this, and this is this, you know, great sort of like very, very over the top performance from Angelica Houston's very sort of thick, you know, accent and this sort of, you know, stern ballet mistress mien that she has. And he has this ticket, which is this rosary, and basically this is his way to get out of the country. Her henchman like heats this, you know, golden cross up in the fire, brands him on his back, and then he says he wants to go to Casablanca. Would you think at first you think is like a, is that a figure of speech? But no, he's actually going to Morocco.
Yes, presumably it's a reference to the film Inception.
And there's no real reason for him to go there except that maybe like they wanted to do some shots that were kind of like orangey instead of like steel blue, so it's good to get out of the city for a little while.
Yeah, but I mean, I think it's interesting to see, like, so we've spent at this point 2 1/3 movies learning how this network of assassins works in New York, and it's the idea of seeing what the whole John Wick cinematic universe is like outside of New York is interesting. So I think that's probably the actual, well, that would be one reason to justify it on an entertainment level. And then on a plot level, I think the reason is just that he is, you know, excommunicado by the table, as it's called, or the high table?
The high table,
The high table. And so he needs to appeal to someone who is, quote-unquote, above the high table. And so that's why he's going to Morocco to visit that figure.
All right. Before we jump to Morocco, Matt, do you want to talk about like what's going on back at home with Ian McShane's character and the rest of the people in the Continental?
Right. Well, so as I think people warned all of those characters during the second movie, siding with John Wick against the High Table has consequences. So there's a character played by Asia Kate Dillon who shows up at the Continental and introduces herself at the front desk as the adjudicator. She says she's an adjudicator, which is not something we've heard of before. And she's sort of a representative of the High Table, of these people who head up the Assassin Society, and is there to clean up after Wick, which means consequences for Winston. They tell him, Ian McShane's character, who runs the Continental, this assassin hotel, that she tells him after 40 years that he's going to be asked to step down. And Lawrence Fishburne, who runs this sort of, again, ludicrous network of homeless people who are also international assassins, is being asked to step down as the head of the network of homeless people who are also international assassins.
The Bowery. He's the Bowery King.
The Bowery. Yeah, I think by the point he leaves for Morocco, all we know is that they're in trouble, but not what form that's going to take.
So yeah, so basically the effect of this is that the adjudicator, the Asia Kate Dillon character, needs to like contract someone out to go after Winston. And so I don't think we know what pronouns this character, the adjudicator, uses. Asia Kate Dillon uses they, them. This is sort of, just as a very quick sidebar, an interesting aspect of these movies, that like they're extremely male-dominated. They're as male-dominated as this conversation is right now. And yet they like have now engaged in a sort of tradition of including characters played by like non-binary actors. The second movie had Ruby Rose in it playing, and she's, I believe she identifies as genderqueer, and she's playing like a mute character. And when they first introduced this Asia Kate Dillon character, the adjudicator, they seemed to sort of nod to the Ruby Rose thing. Like the adjudicator doesn't talk at first either. Like they communicate through various expressions for like the first, I don't know, 30 seconds of their first scene or something. So I don't really know what to make of that, but it's an interesting aspect of these movies that kind of undercuts their general super butch, super male dominatedness a little bit.
Right, and we see in this movie, I think we've gotten glimpses of it before, but we see in this movie kind of the control center that this world of the High Table kind of operates out of. This is where it's this kind of, you know, sort of like steampunk combination of, you know, like sort of old computers with like, you know, green lettered CRT terminals and, you know, switchboards with like, you know, plug in cables and
what it mostly reminds me of, and I can't believe they're still doing this several years later, but like at the time it reminded me exactly of the Hotline Bling video. Like they're all of these very model-esque women running switchboards in outfits that are almost identical to the women running a call center in the Hotline Bling video.
Right. So they've all got like these sort of like, you know, 1940s like secretarial pool outfits on, but they also have like tons of tattoos and like piercings. One of the people who's running this, you know, kind of command center is like, there's a you know, man with like kind of multiple like piercings in his lower lip and stuff like that. So it's this weird kind of, you know, sort of punk, like modern primitive crossed with like, you know, Mad Men office pool aesthetic. And I never know how much to just kind of feel like that's just, you know, window dressing or whatever, but it's like an interesting combination. There is, you know, as I mentioned, the assassins have these kind of, you know, old fashioned phones when they get the text that say like John Wick is, you know, now there's a $14 million price on his head, like in the command center, they write it up on a chalkboard. And it goes out to the assassins and they're getting like, you know, they all have, you know, pre-smartphones that they communicate on and stuff like that. So it's just, you know, I think some of it is just like, it's more visually interesting to see them like kind of flip open the top of their phone than to just like poke at the front of an iPhone or something like that. But it is also, you know, just the thing that these movies are trying to do, maybe to suggest that this is a world that's been going on for a long time and in some ways has kind of like antiquated rules and mores.
Yeah, I mean, It's one of those things where it's like, oh, this thing seems so obviously sexist, but it is so obviously sexist that it almost feels like sexism in quotation marks or something. And then there are these little twists on it along the way.
Yeah, and casting Asia Kate Dillon in this role. I mean, if this, you know, if this role had been played by a cis woman, I mean, this is the character who kind of comes in and tells the boys to stop having fun. You know, she's like wearing right. this, like, you know, like a sort of man suit and got her hair cut short and has this kind of, you know, stern, like, oh, time to stop screwing around. You broke the rules. Now you have to pay for it tone. And it is, and I don't know that casting a, you know, a non-binary actor in it, like, really takes the curse off that, but, like, maybe a little, you know, makes it slightly more complicated than just, like, okay, mom says we have to stop now. So the scene now shifts to Morocco, where John Wick meets an old friend played by Halle Berry, who's actually, like, great in this movie. I feel like it's a small part. She doesn't have, like, a lot of lines, but she just really, and you're like,
why do you say actually, Sam? Oscar-winning actress Halle Berry.
Oscar-winning actress Halle Berry, not the first person I would cast as, like, a hard-bitten, like, assassin who's been
sure.
doing this.
Yeah, Catwoman didn't work out so well for her, I suppose.
She just has a really, and it's a small part, but I mean, she's just like, I can't remember the last time I kind of liked her this much or anything. She's just playing, you know, the sort of, like, very lived in kind of, you know, world weary. She's like a, you know, she's a total badass. She's got some, like, serious hound. She's, like, living in her, you know, palace in Morocco somewhere, and she's not at all happy to see John Wick.
So you're saying she's working in Casablanca when a face from her past shows up unexpectedly?
When you put it like that. Yes.
Another Inception reference.
Yes. So John Wick shows up. He has this little compact thing that I mentioned before. She's not at all happy to see him, does not want to help him. But he has this blood oath that they signed, and she is required to pay off her end of it. So she needs to take him to this a character called Barada, played by Jerome Flynn, who's, you know, best known as the character Bronn on Game of Thrones, doing a very strange accent in this movie. He is the guy who, like, mints the gold coins that we have seen throughout all these movies, and he is going to help John Wick. I think basically the idea is John Wick needs to kind of, like, clear his slate somehow. He's trying to get back to this character called the Elder, who's played by Saeed Taghmoui. And he is going to be, like, out in the desert somewhere, but he needs Bronn. I'm just going to call him Bronn.
Sure.
He needs Bronn to tell him how to get there. Bronn, as he would on Game of Thrones, tells John Wick to fuck off.
Well, specifically, we have to get the dog. We have hardly talked about the dogs.
Let's talk about the
in
dogs.
These movies.
Yes,
and Desim, I feel like you should talk about the dogs. This is probably my favorite sequence in the movie, mostly because of the dogs.
Yeah, so Halle Berry, in addition to being Rick from Casablanca or whatever, also is a dog lover, as all the good people in these movies are, and has two, what are they, German Shepherds?
They're like something in that general ballpark. I don't think they're German Shepherds exactly, but that if listeners can picture German Shepherds. And
she has, attack dogs in any event, which then they later have an entire action sequence built around them using those dogs as weapons, like you would use a pencil or an old Russian book or a motorcycle and a samurai sword. To be clear, not like picking the dogs up and swinging them around like a sword. I mean that they, Halle Berry commands the dogs to attack, and they do that in sort of amazing choreographed things with weapons and the dogs.
Yeah, I mean, basically, it becomes an action sequence in which it's Keanu Reeves, Halle Berry, and these two dogs are all kind of equal participants in taking out this entire, you know, Casablanca hotel full of hitmen. And I just love how, so these movies famously started with a bunch of hitmen killing John Wick's dog, which led to John Wick taking vengeance for an entire movie, which was, like, if you're a dog lover with a little bit of a stomach, as I am, that was just an incredibly wonderful premise for a movie. But I think they also realized that they alienated some portion of would-be fans by killing a dog at the beginning of their movie. And it seems like in the movie's sense, like, they've really gone out of their way to pledge to viewers that the dogs are always going to be okay, which is why it's so wonderful that John Wick is like, take my dog to the Continental and put him under the, you know, protection of the finest hitmen in the world in the earlier scene in the taxi. And in this movie, the dogs get bulletproof vests put on them. And then there's this moment where Braun, I suppose we were calling him, shoots one of the dogs, but we know that the dog has this body armor on, so we just immediately know that the dog's going to be okay and that that guy is fucked.
But it's also it's a dog. It's not like the body armor is hidden under a shirt. So Braun doesn't know that either is a little curious. So Braun, tells them, well, basically Braun says, okay, look, I'll make you a deal. I will tell you where this place is, but I want one of your dogs. And Halle Berry says, no, you can't have one of my dogs. And Braun says, okay, well, then I'm going to kill your dog. And he
shoots it in the bulletproof vest.
Yes, and that, as the saying goes, leads to an argument. So then there is a big-ass gun-slash-dog fight in this hotel. And this is the part, to be clear, like, this is the part where that I have not seen, like, Halle Berry, like, do this kind of, like, intense, like, physical acting before. Yeah. It is a lot of these... You know, basically sort of, you know, stuntman sets. And we know that we've seen Keanu Reeves do this a lot in the Matrix movies and in the previous John Wick movies. But she, like, really holds her own here. And it's the same kind of long takes of, like, you know, her getting thrown around and throwing people around and, you know, shooting people in the head and, you know, sicking her dogs on people. And she's really, like, right in it.
Yeah, it's extremely well choreographed. And my favorite moment in this whole sequence, and I'm curious... how you guys think they did it, is Halle Berry is, you know, shooting a bunch of guys or whatever, and then there's a baddie who's up a wall that's probably like 15 feet above, you know, like at least a story above her. And so she, you know, whistles for one of her dogs to come over, as she does throughout the sequence, and go kill this guy. And then she kind of ducks down to present her back for the dog as a sort of springboard. And so the dog... runs, jumps on Halle Berry's back, and then runs up the wall to climb over it and go kill this guy. And it's sort of like, you know, the whole Fred Astaire running up a wall thing. And I can't tell whether that dog actually did it or whether it was CG.
I mean, I hate to be the guy who, like, always thinks it's CG, but it's probably CG. I mean, this is the curse of, like, watching movies in 2019.
Did you believe that a dog could run up a wall?
In 2019, I believed a dog could fly. Having seen that, there's this dog, the dog trainer who trained the dog from The Artist, I met at one point to see another dog that he was training to do stunts. And it's not implausible to me that that particular dog could have scrabbled up a wall. So because he can do, like, standing backflips and parkour and things, so it's not impossible that they just found a dog that could climb a wall. But but if I had to put money on it, I would bet on CGI.
They taught a dog to do parkour. This is what a country.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes. So John Wick, not surprisingly, wins this fight. He is told that he has to go out into the desert and, like, you know, walk until he's about, like, look up at the star, look at a certain star, and, like, walk till he's dead, and then, like, walk some more, and then maybe if the elder feels like meeting him, we'll meet it. So Halle Berry drives him out there. She sets him on his journey with a little bit of water, which he first, like, makes like she's going to hand to him, just like a little psych move, drinks a little bit of it, like, spits some of it back in the bottle, and then gives him that. And then for some reason, so we see Keanu Reeves, like, hiking up a dune with this little, you know, Volvic bottle in his hand. Why he didn't just, like, drink the water and then not have to carry one more thing, I don't know. But anyway, so he passes out and he wakes up in this tent and he meets the elder, played by Saeed Taghmoui and Forrest. What happens next?
Yeah, just quick. So Taghmoui, who listeners might remember from, like, Three Kings, where he plays a sort of Iraqi hostage or... Wonder Woman, you know, he unfortunately he's kind of always hired to play the one, you know, Arab or Middle Eastern character in the movie, but he's always great. So Taghmoui's character, the elder, presents Wick with a choice, which is basically that Wick can either die or continue to live as a hitman, but he must sort of swear to pledge himself to the High Table, which, you know, if we remember back to the first movie, this was supposed to be Wick doing his, one last job and getting out of the game. But Wick, unfortunately, as always happens in these movies, will never get out of the game. And he gives, we've hardly talked about Wick as a character, which is probably revealing because I don't know how much any of us actually care about Wick as a character rather than as, like, a bullet delivery system. But he's explicitly states his motivation, which is just that he wants to keep living in order to remember his dead wife. It's not the greatest motivation. It's like a textbook example of what critics and TV writers and stuff called fridging. So, which is just like leaving a wife or female love interest in a fridge in order to motivate the male character to kill a bunch of people. So that is what John Wick chooses to do, which sends him back to New York where, oh, the last part of this deal is that he must kill Winston, his sort of like father figure.
Ian McShane, yes.
Yeah.
So he heads back to New York to the Continental.
Let me just say one thing on that. The other thing that I think is important, because I think it's going to be what John Wick 4 will be all about, is he ends up leaving his wedding ring with that guy who heads the high table.
Yes, that is true.
And as somebody who tends to hold a grudge if you take something that's important to him, I feel like that's going to become important.
Yes, he cuts off of something. He is required to cut off his ring finger with a chisel. And yes, so he leaves behind his finger and his ring with this guy and heads back to New York. So meanwhile, in New York, the adjudicator has rounded up a whole new bunch of assassins to take on John Wick, headed by a character named Zero, played by Mark Dacascos, who is a martial artist who will probably be familiar to most people as having done like 240 episodes of Iron Chef America, but also an accomplished martial artist.
Yeah, he was in like Brotherhood of the Wolf, which was this sort of cults or somewhat international hit French movie in like the mid 2000s.
Yeah, and he's done some episodes of Hawaii 5-0 and stuff like that. He's been around for a while. So I think people who kind of know the genre know him, but right. I haven't seen him in a kind of role this high profile like in an American movie before. So he is the character who's kind of like such a big fan. You know, he's like, oh man, John Wick. They're like, really love your work, and now I have to prove that I'm better than you by killing you.
He's so good in this movie. And there's this problem talking about this movie where you kind of don't want to become just another episode of you know, the Chris Farley show from the SNL sketch where you just like restate something that happens and you're like, remember when John Wick killed the guy with the book? That was awesome.
Yeah.
And then the movie, this third one basically makes this Dacascos character, Zero, into that. But like, he is Chris Farley, the host of the Chris Farley show, as a martial arts star.
Yeah, or I thought of like Syndrome in The Incredibles, too.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah,
it's a sort of like bad fan thing. So he has a bunch of, you know, unfortunately, this respect for John Wick does not involve like taking him on one-on-one at first. So he has a whole bunch of henchmen.
It's literally busloads.
Yes.
He sends like two or three double-decker busloads full of hitmen and SWAT gear to the Continental.
Yeah, and that includes, among other people, Yahya Rehan, who you may remember from the Raid movies, or Star Wars, right? No.
Yeah. He was in... he was also in The Force Awakens in like a brief cameo.
Yes, yeah. He was one of the people running around the ship with the big monster where we meet Han Solo in The Force Awakens. So he has a bunch of fights here in a kind of, I think they did the Hall of Mirrors thing in too. So this is more like a Hall of Transparencies. It's a lot of like Lucite glass cases that like Keanu Reeves gets thrown into and shatters. Like there's one shot where he gets thrown into like five of them in a row, that shot, I think it's probably Keanu Reeves' stuntman gets thrown into like five of them in a row. But nonetheless, it is, you know, apparently an unbroken take and like pretty impressive.
Yeah, I mean, it starts off. It feels to me almost. I think it starts off quite self-consciously as a sort of reprisal of the famous lobby scene from the end of the first Matrix, to the extent that there's a conversation between John Wick and Ian McShane, because basically they forge an alliance, right? Ian McShane persuades John Wick to fight with him instead of killing him, and
he essentially convinces them like better to die free than live, you know, in Hawk to the High Table. But also, please don't kill me.
Right. Yeah. And which just leads to him asking John Wick what he needs. And he says, guns, lots of guns, just like before the big Matrix sequence. And so then you have a literal fight in a lobby with Keanu Reeves versus a bunch of SWAT guys in a movie that also features, you know, Lawrence Fishburne. So there's just this way in which these movies have increasingly become kind of the Matrix sequels that many people wanted the second and third Matrix movies to be.
And I should mention that these glass cases that Keanu is getting thrown into are apparently have like sort of glass brains on pedestals inside them or something like
crystal
that.
Crystal skulls.
I mean, but yeah, there's two separate fights here, right? Like there's he goes to the Continental, and then there's a then they send the buses, and then much later they come up to the main area, right? Or am I misremembering?
Yeah, that? that's right. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure we didn't miss the lobby scene before we get to the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Well, the thing that, I was going to say about it is that, like, I feel like these movies, this movie in particular, has kind of the same relationship to Keanu Reeves' other movies that Zero has to John Wick or whatever, because it is just packed with references to old Reeves movies. And you mentioned that lobby fight being from The Matrix and the guns line. But also right before that, they do the scene basically from The Devil's Advocate, where Pacino gives his big monologue to Keanu Reeves, where Al Pacino is the devil and Keanu Reeves is his son, between Winston and John Wick. When they go up, they have a conversation up in that ridiculous crystal office, but they put Winston in front of this giant television screen that moves in sort of like a cloud format that's black and white, that looks a whole lot like that bas relief thing behind Pacino in that scene. And it's basically that scene, if how it would have played out if, you know, Reeves' character had said, yes, I will fight with you, Satan, you know, let's take on the people above us or whatever, because it is that, you know, better to rule in hell than serve in heaven kind of thing, where they're turning against the people.
Did you know what was going on with that screen later? Because that screen is like very prominent in the whole like last 20 minutes of the movies. We keep seeing it out the windows of the sort of upper floors of the Continental. It looks like it's playing like ads for like luxury watches at some point. Like I did, or like some like Hudson Yards, like some new like fancy condo complex. I cannot figure out what's going on.
I assume maybe that was just product placement, that they just wanted to set up like some reason for it to be there, but then they needed video footage, so I would assume they sold that spot.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, you made much more sense of that, all of that set design than I did. I just thought it like was, you know, there was the rule of awesome. They just wanted it to look really cool. The thing it reminded me of is the sequence from Skyfall that is similarly in like a big. I don't know what it is. It's like a hotel full of transparent like
jellyfish
walls and floors and neon lighting, and was basically just like a vehicle for Roger Deakins to have a bunch of fun while shooting an action sequence. And this is not quite as original as that, but it's still pretty effective.
But I also think it's... I mean, there's two things I would say. The first is that I think these movies have kind of an interesting relationship to the Bond movies of like the Roger Moore through GoldenEye era, basically, in that they have these, there's this sort of one-upmanship where they're trying to do harder versions of the same stunts that they did in previous movies, you know, like the mirror sequence in the second one. Well, what's harder than shooting in something where everything's reflective, shooting in something where everything's transparent, so let's do that. But I would also say, like, the thing that I love about John Wick movies is you see these environments and you immediately know, oh wow, they're going to do these sorts of stunts and these sorts of disasters in them. Like you don't see a John Wick set and think, wow, that looks really cool. Or I don't anyway. I think, wow, this is going to blow up real good. And then it does. So like when John Wick walking into a room that is filled with like 20 giant crystal display cases with skulls in them, you know that people are going to just get thrown through them. And then there's a shot in one of those fights where they just, I want to say it's like five of them in a row.
Yeah.
They just,
it feels
somebody
like a joke.
Picks up John Wick, throws him through the glass. John Wick falls down. The guy walks over, picks him up, throws him through the glass.
Yeah, it's like
very efficiently. I love that. Like every time you see glass in a John Wick movie, my heart sings because I know what's going to happen.
Yeah, I think there are a few comedies that have done a sort of spoof of the way that panes of glass seem to always appear in action movies. I know there's a spoof of it in, I think, like Wayne's World 2, where they like are running through an alley and some guys are just carrying a pane of glass through the alley, and then they like the guys carrying the pane of glass, like they're like, whoa, wait, back up so that they can run through it. It feels like that, just with a straight face.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love it. It's very efficient.
All right. So anyway, so there's even more awesome fighting in this one. There's a shot that I'm particularly fond of where like he's fighting two people with swords and one of the guys gets stuck, and then one of the swords gets stuck, and then Keanu just kind of like throws the other guy like into the sword that's stuck in a thing. To kill him, like he's not even swinging it, he's just kind of using it as like a stationary, you know, slicing surface. So John Wick is triumphant here. He gets back to his dog, and then we have this sort of final.
Can we just talk about one more moment?
Oh, but please,
I forgot.
Yeah,
in terms of, I mean, we should. I feel like all get an opportunity to just name our like favorite John Wick Hill that we haven't talked about yet or something. But there's this, my favorite from this was the payoff to a moment earlier in the movie where John Wick shows up, I think it's maybe in the Saeed Taghmoui scene, and he has to like turn over his gun or whatever in order to make everyone safe. But then they're like, oh, and your belt too. And you're just like, what? Like the viewer, it's kind of funny, but it seems really random. And then it has this payoff in this final scene where John Wick, in the middle of a fight scene, all of a sudden just takes off his belt and starts whipping all of the bad guys with it. And then like binding them in the belt and basically does everything like that the choreographers and stuntmen and Keanu Reeves himself on this movie could possibly think of for John Wick to do with a belt. And it's very wonderful.
Right. It is. I mean, it is not to like, you know, force the comparison too hard, but it did. It does. It is a little kind of Iron Chef like where it's just like you come into the room and it's like, OK, you got a head of broccoli and two eggs and some chili paste. Like, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah.
You know, just like exhaust every possibility with these like three objects.
Well, the other thing that it reminded me of a lot, the way that these scenarios are constructed is video games, that it's sort of like, you know, fighting the archives with pistols only or whatever. They keep varying what weapons are available to people. But before we move on from the Continental fight, I wanted to say one other thing about it, which is that that was also the sequence that most reminded me of video games, because the people who show up in the bus that invade the Continental are wearing these helmets that mean that they can't just be headshot at a distance the way that Wick has been killing people the whole time. And it's sort of that classic video game thing, like, well, this enemy you've got to fight a little bit differently. And then they kind of work through him figuring out how to do that, which he does. And then you have, before he fights Zero, you have these two other swordsmen that are sort of like a classic video game mini boss thing that he has to fight. And it just sort of escalates in a way that is not so much, I think, takes its cues from video games more than cinema.
Right. And one of the things I like about the kind of body armor twist in the lobby scene that you're mentioning is that, like, it's the movie never tells you that. Like, it's just, John all of a sudden is shooting people like five times and kind of instead of once or, you know, twice. And it doesn't, and then there's never no point where he's like, damn, body armor.
Yeah.
You know, he just eventually he starts like flipping up the visors to people's helmets and shooting them in the face. That when you're like, oh, they have body armor on or something. But it's, I mean, you know, the people on motorcycles had helmets and that did not seem to stop him from shooting them in the head. So it's just kind of like you pick it up kind of by osmosis as you're watching this. And I subtlety is probably not a word to bring into a discussion of these movies, but it's nice. They underplay it a little bit, which I like. All right, so to wrap up the plot, and this is my one sort of real issue with this movie. As we wrap up the plot, we kind of get everybody together on the roof of the hotel. You have Ian McShane's character, Winston, Lance Reddick, who's kind of his, you know, faithful concierge, and the adjudicator. And the adjudicator says to Ian McShane, basically, like, his life is forfeit now, too, and the only chance that he has is to kill John Wick. And after John Wick, after putting his life on the line in the first place to give John Wick an extra hour to get away from the Continental, and after having his life effectively saved by John Wick, Winston just says, sure. And so John Wick comes back up to the roof. Ian McShane shoots him several times. Keanu Reeves goes over the edge, you know, flips off several, you know, awnings and fire escapes and things to theoretically break his fall. So you can sort of believe that he would survive, like, falling five stories to a cobblestone
street. Yeah, I don't know how good a job the fire escape did of breaking his fall.
Yes.
It's like a weird combination of cushioning his fall and making it look more gruesome.
And Lance Reddick says, you know, well played, sir. And, like, that's that. And I feel like, I don't care about the plot in these movies at all. But that just seems like, but you were sort of telling me that I was supposed to, and I was supposed to care about this sort of like father-son bond between these like two characters. And now you're just like, oh, but you know, when push comes to shove, like Ian McShane's just going to shoot him because it's him or me.
Well, they try to explain it, right? I don't know that it totally makes sense, but from what I remember, the explanation that they try to offer is that, so after Ian McShane does this and, you know, Lance Reddick says, well played, sir, there's somebody comments like, oh, I get it. Like, Winston was making a show of force. And basically, as the head of the Continental, he was showing the high table, like, how much he could do before they would actually just kind of, like, make a deal with him to respect him. And so maybe that makes sense in a really convoluted way. They at least tried. But, yeah, I felt a little impatient with that sequence.
Well, I mean, he shoots... You felt impatient with it because you didn't think that... I don't think that that was like a real betrayal. He shoots him in the body armor over the edge there. I guess...
I don't think
that Winston is like planning, like thinking the best thing for you right now is to fall five stories, but I think like he did it in a way that there was a, that Wick would have some kind of a chance.
Yeah. I guess, you know, like he does live in the John Wick universe in which you can fall five stories and not, die. So I guess armed with that knowledge, he's like, well, maybe if I just kind of shoot him in the body armor and he goes over the edge,
the fire
like,
escape,
there's a chance he'll survive. Even having watched three of those movies, that's a little hard for me to swallow, but yeah, that's something. But, well, I mean, but John,
if Winston had wanted to be sure that John Wick was dead, Winston would have made sure that John Wick was dead, you know?
Right. John seems to take it personally because the end of this movie, which is just a giant, which I mean, is just a big fat promo for John Wick 4, which I'm also never like a huge fan of, but is he reunites, we haven't talked about Lawrence Fishburne's character hardly at all, but he is also someone who is, you know, we're thought is dead, is sort of sided with John Wick, and we thought been murdered by the adjudicator and their henchmen. You know, he got 7 slices from a samurai sword, but apparently just got a kind of nasty cut above the eyebrow. So he is still, you know, ruling in his little sewer kingdom, and John Wick finds his way back to him, and they basically kind of agree to like get, you know, revenge together, and then they laugh and something, and then the end credits come up.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was I'm not saying it definitely doesn't make sense. I do think it was probably partly just the nature of it feeling like a teaser for a sequel that that kind of bothered me, or just like I just would have preferred that the movie let me enjoy John Wick 3 for a little bit longer before advertising John Wick 4 and asking me to think about that. That All said, right. Teasing the possibility of Keanu Reeves and Lawrence Fishburne teaming up in John Wick 4 does seem like an effective piece of marketing for a movie I will definitely want to see.
All right, yeah, and we'll close by asking that. I mean, Matt, are you in for John Wick 4?
I feel like they're running out of glass surfaces to smash, so yes, I want to see what they could possibly do to top that Winston's office.
See, I mean, I think as with the Fast and Furious series, like they just need to go to space next. Yeah. John Wick
in Zero Gravity, I would definitely
John
watch.
Wick Chapter 4, Spacebellum. all right, thank you for listening to this spoiler special. And if you have any suggestions for future movies or TV series for us to spoil, email us at spoilers@slate.com. Our engineer has been Merritt Jacob, and our producer is Daniel Hewitt. Thank you for listening.